part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
This is Part-Time Fanboy. I am Christian Horn, and I am back here with my friend Jay Holtham, and we are here to talk about the original, well, quote-unquote original, Magnificent Seven.
Right.
Starring Yul Brynner, Eli Wallach, Steve McQueen, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn, Brad Dexter, James Coburn, and introducing... Damn it, I lost his name. The German...
Horst Buchholz.
Yeah, yeah, what was his name?
Horst Buchholz.
Oh, that's which right.
And I believe he's playing a Mexican.
Yes.
I love movies.
Yes, that's right. And it's really funny because, yeah, I... Well, first of all, I love this movie. Like, this is the original Magnificent Seven. And when I say quote unquote original Magnificent Seven, obviously based off of Akira Kurosawa's, you know, fantastic film, The Seventh Samurai, which I did not have time to rewatch. I was like, and the reason we're doing this is because there's a Magnificent Seven remake of the remake in theater, which I guess there have been several kind of takes throughout the years, but there's a version in the theaters, which I have not seen. I don't know if you saw it
yet. Not yet.
I really wanted to rewatch the original, and I wanted to talk about it because it is kind of one of my favorite movies of all time. I mean, like, I don't know, top 20, top 10, you know, I don't know how, there's so many great movies that I love, but it is a movie that the first time I think I saw it in the movie theater, it wasn't the first time I had seen it, but the first time I saw it in the movie theater, I was like, holy cow, this is very impactful. And it's like a solid flick. So,
I wish I'd been able to see this in a theater.
Oh, you've never seen it in the theater?
I've never seen it in a theater. That would be so great.
No, it's great. I'd
see it at like the Vista or something.
Yeah, I can't remember where I saw it. There used to be a Revival House in Pasadena. I used to live in Pasadena, and there was this like kind of rundown theater, and they would show like old movies all the time. And I think that's where I may have seen it on the big screen. I'm not exactly sure, but... Yeah, and I mean, I'd seen it on video originally and really thought it was fantastic, but when I saw it on the big screen, I was like, wow, I'm getting it, you know what I mean? And rewatching it this time, I picked up on, like, I'm sure this is stuff that I knew. I haven't seen it in years and years and years, but there was a lot of stuff in there where I was like, wow, there's a lot of, like, undertones in this movie that I didn't realize the first couple of times I watched it, you know?
Yeah, I had exactly the same experience rewatching it this weekend, and like, it's a much sadder movie than I remember.
Sure, yeah.
Like, there's a lot of fun, and it's so much fun, and it's so light and sort of comical in a lot of ways, but like, there is such a like undertone of sadness and sort of loss to it. I forgot how miserable the lives of basically the Magnificent Seven are.
Yeah, they're not like, so magnificent.
All of them are so miserable.
Yeah.
And like depressing in a way.
Yeah.
And there's a part of it that does feel like it's saying goodbye to something that's really in a really sort of graceful way.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because I don't know about you, but as a kid, I did not like Westerns. Like as a kid, I was like, who cares? There's a bunch of guys like on horses. I don't care. I never played like cowboys and Indians. Like we grew up like Star Wars and comic books. And so I was running around pretending I was like a superhero or like in space or Captain Kirk. Like we were sort of that like era where like sci-fi was becoming. So like growing up, I always thought Westerns were like old and tired and I never got it. And it just didn't click with me. I was like, who cares? Bunch of dirty old horses. I don't want, you know, and we're kind of like, you and I grew up in the same area. Like we're right outside of New York City. You know, there was growing up as a kid there, to me, there was like no appeal to like riding a horse. Like, we were kind of like city kids in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we were right outside of New York City. So, like, God forbid I have to go out on a horse and, like, you know, go camping or whatever. Like, I
was not
into that at all. No. So, the thing is, like, it wasn't until I think I moved to California and I saw Unforgiven in the theater. And I was like, oh, wait, like, this is really good. And then I used to wait tables in Pasadena, and there was this guy, a really nice guy. He used to do stand-in work for Robert Redford, at least that's what he said. And he used to come in with movie recommendations, and he started recommending stuff to me. And I think one of those recommendations may have been The Magnificent Seven. And, you know, there was no internet then, and there was more time to just, like, hang out and do whatever. And especially if you were an unemployed actor and, you know, you weren't doing anything. So I rented The Magnificent Seven, and I remember being, like, blown away. And it's one of those moments, like, as a young adult, or, like, you know, late teens or whatever, young adult, early 20s, where you're like, damn, I'm not as smart as I thought I was.
Right.
There's a lot of, like, amazing stuff in the world that I really haven't been exposed to, and I should be more open-minded about stuff. You know what I mean? Because, like, it was so intense, you know what I mean, as a viewing thing. And it wasn't just like, oh, we're going to shoot Indians and chase down, like, the characters were very layered, and there's a lot of, like, different motivations happening. And and there's, you know, just like you said, a sadness, you know what I mean?
There's such a sweet... It's got such a weird, sweet heart to it all, too.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's interesting you mentioned Unforgiven. Like, I didn't grow up on Westerns. I like you said, I never played Cowboys and Indians.
Yeah.
But The Magnificent Seven was, like, the one Western. It's probably the first Western I ever saw.
Oh, really?
And I saw it when I was a kid, and I loved it instantly. I mean, because it is so funny and so sort of simple and sweet and... And this is the first time that I really sort of – it's been a while since I've seen it, but, like, I really got into the sort of the adult message of it, particularly about cowboys and Indians, and sort of the notions of the Old West of these, you know, seven tough gunslingers, all of whom are basically like, there's nothing left for me in this life. You know, there's that great sequence in the towards the end of it where they literally say that, where they all sit around and talk about how they have nothing. As they basically try to discourage the kid Horst Buckholz from pursuing a life as a gunslinger, and it's just heartbreaking, really. So I was always aware of it as a movie that I've returned to a couple of times. I'm not really big on many of the sort of classic Westerns. I think I've seen The Searchers once. I don't think I've seen Stagecoach. You know, one of those sort of late ones that I put in the same place as, like, True Grit, the original, and also the recent remake, and Unforgiven, as in a way being more about the other side of the myth of the West.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because you start to growing up, there's such a stereotype of the Western, right? Like, I mean, the thing that you always see is kind of like Roy Rogers or the Lone Ranger or Bonanza. You know, those are the sort of things that may have been rerunning on TV all the time that give you this, like, yeah, it's cowboys and Indians, good guys, bad guys. This is simplistic. Like, as much fun as people made for me as, like, reading comic books and, like, this is simple children's. And, like, I always just thought, like Westerns were one dimensional. And then I think the very first big Western that I ever, and I saw this one at the Dome in Hollywood, the first time, I think this was the first big Western that just sort of blew the doors off. Like, I was like, oh my God, like, this is amazing, was The Wild Bunch. And seeing that on the big screen, like, I was like, the first realization was like, okay, now I get why everyone's, like, ripping on Tarantino for, like, copying or aping off of, like, people's style. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh my God, this is like Tarantino, like, all the way. Like I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is like Reservoir Dogs. Like, I was freaking out in the theater. I was like, I'm basically watching. But then the other thing of, like, sort of like that there's more dimension to the characters than just like, you know, because growing up, the Western was sort of like John Wayne, you know, like he was right. synonymous with, right. and John Wayne to me growing up was just like this heavy set guy that was like, hello, Pilgrim, yep. kind of a racist, not tolerant of other yep. people, you know what I mean? And that wasn't something that I ever like catered to or thought was like cool, was like, hey man, mm-hmm. the, my way is the right way, you know, but as yep. you discover like the Wild Bunch or even the Magnificent Seven or even Sergio Leone's, you know, stuff like Once right. Upon a Time yeah. in the West or, you know, the stuff with the Man with No Name, the yep. Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, you really yep. start to see like dimensions that are like, there's a dimension of character and a depth of uh-huh. like subtext that you're just like, whoa, I like, this is yeah. deeper than anything. And you can see how it speaks to sort of the male persona of like, uh-huh. especially people getting older, where you're just sort of like, a lot of these old West, like the Wild Bunch, Magnificent Seven, like you said earlier, is sort of about like, or Lonely Are the Brave, stuff like that. It's sort of about like fading off into the sunset. Like, and yeah. you can see why men in particular are like, into these sort of things. Like yep. it's just really yeah. wild, you know, having that realization when I was younger and then sort of having it reaffirmed now that I'm older, watching the Magnificent Seven again, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, there's so much about sort of what kind of person you want to be and what kind of man you are. And like, and there are all of these, even in this sort of like male archetypes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like between Yul Brynner's, you know, Chris
yeah.
as the leader, and Vin, who's sort of the sardonic, like, not exactly like sidekick, but, you know, he's just sort of
a little sarcastic,
a little world weary, yeah, a little yeah. sarcastic, but still tough. And they're so also like taciturn and but decent, and it's just it's so much like, what kind of person are you going to be?
Yeah,
what makes a man?
Yeah,
you know,
what are the decisions that you make, and like, what are the, and it's really funny because even, I mean, we should definitely talk about the plot at some point for people right. who have never heard or seen of the movie, but like the Eli Wallach character is not like this one dimensional sort of like mustache twisting villain. He is very much like, look, I've got men to feed. Like, I don't want to mm-hmm. work. You know what I mean? Like
yep.
we are yeah. bandits, you know? And if you start to sort of like maybe unfold, like in your imagination, his history, maybe he's fought in some wars, maybe all he's,
right.
he says, I mean, and that, you know, that he's like, I'm very much like, we're sort of the same. I'm
yep.
just had a harder path, or, you know, whatever. It's
yep.
there's no,
yeah.
there's not excusing him, but it's very much like, I'm not so different from you. It's that sort of like,
right.
you and I are very much the same, but not, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
And Eli Wallach, I mean, okay, he's playing a Mexican. Like, let's get that out of the way. As like being half Latino. Yeah. Being half Latino, seeing like, you know, basically German people and, you know, like white people
yes.
in makeup, like playing. But Eli Wallach is so amazing at it that it's just it's unbelievable. And it's
yeah.
a precursor to his performance in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. It's almost the same guy, but in slightly different ways. And it's fascinating because I forgot how many great lines there are in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And he has that terrific one about if they weren't meant to be shorn, why would God make them sheep or
yeah,
something along
yeah.
those lines.
That's where, a great
and
line.
It's like, it's so cold-hearted, but like, dude's got a point. It's like there yeah. are sheep and there are wolves, and
yeah,
it's
yeah.
a dark worldview. But you know what? You gotta give him credit for like sticking to it. Like, he's not doing it because he's mean. He's not bad. You're right. He's feeding his men, and this is the only way he knows how.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, he is scum. Let's put it, you know. But I mean, there's definitely. And there's even lines like, why don't you go get a job? Why don't you go work for your food? You know what I
yeah.
mean? And he's like, what? Me work? What? You know, why would I do something like that? You know what I mean? It's just, it's such
yeah.
an outstandingly slimy, but charismatic performance by Eli Wallach. It's so funny. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the plot a little bit, because I mean, basically, it's kind of simple. There is a Mexican village, you know, somewhat, and
somewhere near the border.
Somewhere near the border, and they are like every couple of months or so, a gang of bandidos or whatever will ride on through and basically take a chunk of their food for themselves, you know. Basically, it seems to be about food and stuff like that. They never really get into anything like dark or, you know, which maybe a modern interpretation, like, do they take our women? Like, you know what I mean? Like that sort of thing. No. But it's basically mostly about food and resources that the village, a farming village, has worked incredibly hard for. And, you know, as farmers do, and these guys just roll in and take what they want and leave them with enough to survive on. And at some point the villagers get fed up and they sort of come up with a plan to, basically hire some gunmen to scare the bandits off. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. That's their plan. I mean, originally the first level of their plan is they were going to buy guns themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then they were like, but we're farmers, let's hire some guys. Such a great sequence at the beginning, the way they figure out that to hire these guys is, in some ratty little tombstone-y village, there's an Indian, a Native American who's supposed to be buried in Boot Hill, and a bunch of guys won't let him. And two just total strangers, Chris and Vin, offer to ride the corpse, the coffin, into Boot Hill and get the guy buried. And it's just this like great, simple, noble thing. And so they hire them, and then they bring five other guys back to the town to fight against the banditos.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really funny because, well, that sequence, first of all, is just like amazing. They show up in the town and I love it because like you're sort of like, you sort of get dropped into the middle of the action where this guy is arguing with, what do you call them? And I almost said obstetrician.
The Undertaker.
And basically like, why won't you bury this guy? And he's like, I'm happy to take your money, but I can't bury him. And they sort of go back and forth a little bit and you're sort of like, huh, what?
Yeah.
And then, you know, it comes out, yeah, he's Native American, and there's a lot of people in this town that are, and he even says, like, the guy who wants to pay for the burial, because he felt bad for the guy because he was just like shot in the middle of the street and like left there and nobody cared about him. He basically said, oh, you're prejudiced. And I was like, this is 1960. What? Like, this is great. Like,
called it right out.
Yeah, he calls it right out. He's like, you're prejudiced. And he basically says, like, that's why you won't bury him. And then there's that, it's like, bam, that moment where it like kicks in and Yul Brynner is like, ah, if that's all that's doing it, I'll do it. Like, if this is a holdup, you know, I'll do it. Like, nobody wants to drive the hearse or whatever. He's like, if that's the big deal, I'll take care of it myself. And then, you know, he climbs on and then it becomes like a betting game, like with a bunch of the bystanders, you know, like, oh, wait, I want to see this, you know, and it's just a great sequence. And like, it shows you like how this movie in particular, as far as American, like sort of like action movie cinema is concerned, this is the sort of getting the gang together template, you know, for anything that came afterwards, you know, whatever, you know, the Fast and the Furious, the Dirty Dozen, you know, anything like that, Ocean's 11 or whatever. This is the American movie that influences all others that come after it, because all those sequences, they take up a lot of time, but they're absolutely essential in showing, you know, how, different they all are, like how they're sort of in it for their own reasons, you know what I mean? And I'm really wondering if the modern version takes its time with that, you know what I'm saying?
Like, I wonder if it takes time, but I also wonder if it takes too much time, because one of the other things that I love about this is that they establish who each of these guys are so quickly efficiently and without any unnecessary backstory.
Like,
there's a great little moment with Yul Brynner where the guy who paid for the funeral asks him where he came from, and he just points backwards.
Yes.
And he asks him where he's going and he points forward. And like, that's it. Like, that's all we need. we know who this guy is. We know who he, what he's about.
Yeah.
And same thing for each of the other ones that are introduced. They're just like the scenes are super short.
Yeah.
I think James Coburn has like 7 lines in the entire movie.
Yeah.
And he's, but he's still super cool as Red, who's as good with a gun as he is with a knife.
And
it's just, it is, you're exactly right. It's that template of like, each guy has his specialty. Each guy has his reason that he's doing it. And his connection to the leaders. And yeah, it's just sort of like they put the pieces together, and then see how they work.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me because the thing that I kept thinking about while I was watching this movie was a lot of the Marvel movies, and in particular Batman versus Superman, where I was just like, where the complaint was about scene work. And for me, like the biggest thing was like scenes not following through. And even with not that much dialogue, there's just like, it's a brevity of storytelling, but it doesn't feel rushed. And it feels complete. Like at the end of each sort of like recruitment session, it's like end scene. Like, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like it's like beginning, middle, and something happens. And even like Robert Vaughn, who's sort of like whose intro is kind of like short, but you get like everything you need to know from that one. Like I absolutely love that. Like, And then there was something, again, one of the things that I never caught on, like I never thought about before. Like I was just always thought he was like a fancy Dan. Like I just dress up and, you know, I'm very, you know, but now I'm in trouble. I'm run out of luck. Like I'm at the end of my rope. But then there's that one sequence, like when he walks out and Steve McQueen looks at Yul Brynner and kind of makes that hand motion.
Yep.
And I was like, are they insinuating that he's a homosexual? Like, I was like, is that what they're insinuating? Or are they insinuating that he's just like a fancy Dan and he's not sure of him? Like, I was like, what are they saying there? Like, oh, and was I reading too much into that? Or was that there? Like, you know
That's
what I mean?
Interesting.
Like, because I was like, it could be read like so many weird ways. And I never caught on to that before. Where I was like, is it that he's not sure about him being in the group because he doesn't like dudes that dress up like super fancy and he doesn't trust that he's a good gun? Or is it that he just doesn't want like one of those guys around? Like, I was just like, it was just like really weird to me because it just like, it's what popped into my head. And it's amazing how like a movie like this or a great movie, you know, a classic movie, a timeless movie, you're just going to pick up like as time changes, you just pick up on all this stuff that may or may not be there. That may not be there. That may not be what the intent was. But like for me, I was like, is that what he's saying? What does that say about me? What does that say about the movie? You know what I mean? It just gives you food for thought, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's another great thing about like that era of filmmaking all the way up to like the early 70s. I hadn't thought that, but that is definitely a running thread. Like I took that scene and this was another time that like I don't know how much I thought about it before, that I always thought that like there was something shady about him. I didn't think about the sexuality part, which is interesting. Yeah. I just always thought that, like, and as they show him later, that he's a bit of a coward.
Oh, yeah,
that they don't know that they can trust him. Though, mostly because, like, oh, God, that's such a great, like, the great thing that I love about that is, again, the economy of not giving us a bunch of backstory about who he is or where he's been.
Yeah.
But just understanding that, like, you know, he says he needs $20 and that'll just cover his room. And yeah, Steve McQueen is like, wow, you must be living fancy. And he's like, no, it buys me a corner in the back.
yeah.
And a plate of beans for 2 nights.
Yeah.
And you're like, dude, what have you done?
Yeah, there's something
that is
really
so
bad.
Terrible.
Yeah. Like you've really tapped out. And even during the first gunfight, like he chickens out, like he hides.
Yeah,
basically he doesn't contribute
totally,
at all.
Yeah,
you know. And
And
it's just, you're absolutely right. Like the thing that kept blowing me away while I was watching it is, again, you're absolutely right, where it's like they give you just enough and they don't need to tell you anymore, you know. And modern movie making or modern writing, it's just like it feels like there's so many movies where they feel like they have to spell everything out, and it's like, no, I got it. Because when you think about it, like, these guys are all templates. You know what I mean? They're mm-hmm. sort of all templates for sort of like basic right. male, you know, whatever, male ego yeah. or something, you know, and they all have like different levels to which they're willing to go, you know? And like Yul right. Brynner's like obviously like the Fonzie of the group, right? Like Yul Brynner yep. is yep. the calm, cool, collected one. But at the same time, like when it comes to our friend, I keep forgetting his name, Horst, our Horst. Friend Horst, Horst, who is quite honestly sort of in a way the stand-in for the audience, you know,
because
he embodies that sort of like, aren't cowboys and Indians cool? Isn't being the yep. hero cool? Isn't like shooting and fighting and you know, doing all
this
killing Indians. Like, this is going to be fun and we're going to have fun. And that is sort of what I, and probably a lot mm-hmm. of people are like, action movies, like, this is what it's all about, right?
Yeah.
And the attitude of everyone else, all the other gunslingers, is very much like, it's not that, you know, it's not all about yeah. that. And it's really funny because going back a little bit to what I was saying before, there's a bit of me that's like, because these are all artists, like everyone is an yeah. actor, everyone here is like a director, a writer, like this is basically, yep. you know, they're crafting something. In the larger scope of things, like it was almost like to me, like what life as a performer is like, mm-hmm. right? Because yeah. there are these yeah. guys who have given up a lot. They never settled down. They never had a family. They never, you know, and in reality, like Yul Brynner at this point had probably been married twice, like three times, you
right.
know? And
right.
it's just sort of like a deeper context to like, well, you can follow this dream if you want, but you're not right. guaranteed, you know, like the song says, you're not always going to get what you want. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
like it's yeah. not going to come out the way that you think. And in a lot of ways, you may end up being that, you know, person that just never achieved anything or has nothing
exactly.
to show for it. You know,
at the end of the day, you know, I mean, there's that, it's such a great, I mean, like, it's a theme that comes up so often in this movie. There's that great point when there's the trio of little like boys who latch on to Charles Bronson's character and they like follow him around and
yeah.
they say they're going to avenge his death
yeah.
and all of this stuff. And they call their fathers cowards
yes.
and he explodes at him. He spanks one of the kids
yeah.
and he says, your fathers are working hard for you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like there's nothing cowardly about what they're doing because they're doing it to protect you.
Yeah.
And it's such great, like such a powerful thing.
Yeah.
Especially from that character. And it's his introduction as well is great. Because he recounts that he's chopping wood
yeah.
for basically
yeah.
for food and housing.
Scene. And Charles Bronson, and they, like what? He's like the Sylvester Stallone of like the '60s. Like he was ripped.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was so ripped. He's, you know, he's chopping wood and they recount like they recount all of the great things he's done and how, you know, how much money he was paid, $600 for one job and $800 for another job. And this job, they're paying
$20. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
$20.
At first, he sort of shrugs and he's like, I'm going to do it because right now, that's a lot of money for me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Well, I love that Steve McQueen line where he's like, you cost a lot. And he's like, yeah, it costs a lot. And then they walk away and he's like, I'll take it. And they're like, $20? He's like, right now, $20 is a lot. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, he's basically chopping wood in the back of someone's yard for like room and board, you know?
Exactly.
But I remember that specific Charles Bronson scene. First of all, the first time I saw the movie, I was like, that's Charles Bronson? Jeez, what happened to you, guy? Like, you were like, quote, you were like a beautiful man. Like, what happened?
Yeah.
And then, but the scene with the children, I remember the first time I saw it, like, just nailing me, being like, what is this doing in this movie? Like, what is this message? Like, this is like a very deep sort of kind of message that you're trying to...
Yeah.
And... You don't expect that from an action movie. You don't expect it from a movie that is supposedly about gunslingers, like, da-da-da-da-da, you know? Again and again, this sort of thing stands out in the genre because it sort of bends it. It sort of twists it
yep.
and takes it in different directions, you know?
Yep, and in subtle ways. It's not like...
Oh, yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's not a big sort of, like, deconstruction of the Western. It's just a Western made in 1960 as that, like... period of Westerns was obviously coming to an end.
Yeah.
And it's just capturing whatever that feeling of the time was, that there was a changing of the guard in a certain way. And I feel like that's, if there's any reason why to remake this movie. And like, I'm always agnostic about remakes. There are sometimes it's valid. Yeah. I think this is totally valid. I mean, it's a story that's been remade already like 4 or 5 times. There's what, Battle Beyond the Stars,
A Bug's
is
Life.
That terrible A Bug's Life, which yeah. sort of combines this and The Three Amigos, which is a parody of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Since they get actors instead of actual gunslingers.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is something important about this version of it and about that sense of a world that is about to be passed by.
Yeah, yeah.
And what comes next. Like, there's something to the fact that at the end of the movie, the same two guys ride off, and they're the only ones who ride off into a pretty uncertain future.
Yeah,
Whereas, you know, Horst Buchholz is going back to what he truly was, which is a farmer.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone else is dead.
Well,
spoilers, sorry. Spoiler.
Well, the Horst Buchholz character, for some reason, like this time, just like really, it nailed me. Like this guy, I mean, what's really funny to me is, well, first of all, okay, like, obviously there's a different style of sort of acting. Like there's different ranges right. of like everyone's technique in this movie. Horst Buchholz yep. to me is like, he's landed right on the James Dean. Like, I'm going to yep. James Dean the hell out of this movie. I'm going to James Dean it. And we're going to James Dean. And this is East of Eden. And no, which one is it?
You're
like,
where tearing, he's
like,
you're me, tearing apart. Me apart.
Yeah. He's totally like, he is James Deaning it all the way to the bank. Like he is. But yep. The thing that, I mean, I always knew this. I always knew, and they actually say it towards the end of the movie, so I must have always been consciously aware of it, where he was a farmer. Like, that's where he comes right. from. And but for some reason, I really just hooked into that disdain in the beginning
yeah.
because somebody calls him, like, Campesino. They say, like, hey, Campesino. Yeah. And he turns around, and he's like, you know, like, he's got this look on his face, like, don't you ever... like call me
yeah.
that. And it's just like, it really nailed me because like we grew up, I mean, you and I have known each other, you know, we knew each other in high school and kind of like growing up and
yep.
lost touch for a long time, but we grew up in an area that was very sort of like Blanco, right? Like, let's just say
yes.
there's a lot of white people. Yeah, extremely. Like, we lived right outside of New York City, but our suburb was very, you know, so if yep. you were not, I mean, I can pass, like, obviously people meet me and they're like, wait, you're half Latino. Like, what? You know, so I have that very Germanic, but there's always that feeling of sort of like being an outsider. And
yep.
growing up, I felt that very much and very much would sort of be embarrassed by Latino stereotypes that people would like embrace mm-hmm. growing up. So like, for some reason, I mean, I always knew that he had this disdain, but I was like, I sort of recognized that like in myself
oh,
this
yeah.
time. And I was like, oh my God, that's terrible. Like, you know, because it
yeah.
took a long time. Like, it wasn't up until I moved to LA where you're surrounded by Latin people now. And there's a pride in that culture and it changes
yep.
your worldview. And I was like, oh yeah. Okay. Like, I'm good here, you know? And the journey that he goes through, because I think that, like, that character, I'm delving way too much into this character. I apologize mm-hmm. for anybody.
Well, he's the central character in this movie. He really is.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the one person who changes
yeah.
And becomes different. You're right, he's the audience surrogate. He, all of those things, like, he is the character that's worth it. All this level of, like, in-depth conversation.
Yeah. Well, and I also think that he is also the person that, like you said, he grows, he has like his arc, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, towards the end, it's a little kind of like, it's a little quick the way he like turns around. He's like, okay, I'm just going to do
right.
this. And, you know, obviously it's a Hollywood movie, but there's just this thing of like, what is it that we're all looking for? You know, and
right,
the message
yeah.
is sort of like, what we're all looking for is kind of like love. Maybe back then mm-hmm. was to like settle down, have a wife. And he's fighting so hard against that because he thinks that this thing, being a gunslinger and a man with a gun, is going to give him the thing that he wants. But then he finds it and it's like, oh, wait, like, this is what I want. You know what I mean? Like, this is what I'm looking for. Appreciation, you know, love, tenderness, you know, respect from, you know, and it happens, obviously, to happens to be from a woman that is of the opposite sex, you know, and he has the revelation, I think, that, you know, these older gunslingers never had, which is like, maybe this is what I should have been seeking out, in a way, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or maybe that is what the fulfillment of our dreams is, in a certain way. Like, it's such a wild message for this sort of thing, where it's very, you know, for years and years, this theme song was used in like Marlboro commercials, right?
Yeah.
And like you know, very macho and we're men and blah, blah, blah. But at the core, this is not, I don't see like being a very manly movie. I see it being very sensitive, right?
Yeah, no, it's super sensitive. And ultimately, like I said, entirely about, and like you're saying, entirely about, it's in some ways better to choose not to fight. It's better to just be who you truly are.
Yeah.
And that these guys, you know, those, the Chris and Vin, watching him ride back into town, are pretty sad. And like I said, he's able to do something they're not able to do.
Yeah.
Vin makes a couple jokes about it, about like, wouldn't it be nice to just go and be a regular farmer somewhere?
Yeah.
But you know, that's not what it's going to be for him.
Well, that's such great delivery by Steve McQueen, too. He's just so wistful and just like, he's like, wouldn't it be nice to just like, or wouldn't it be nice to like, when they get, because they eventually, they stand up to the bandits show up. They stand up to the bandits, they rout them out. And then the bandits manage to be able to sneak it back into the village and get rid of them. And as they're being sort of like gathering their stuff, McQueen and Yul Brynner have this like fantastic scene where like Steve McQueen is like, you know, he's like, I know you got attached and I was a sucker too. And the reason I know that you're hurting is because I'm hurting, because I started to actually think like, hey, maybe there's a life for me here. Like maybe this is what I could. And then, you know, it's kind of like a really deep message, because it's like violence begets violence. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And, but at the same time, it's very much like you do have to stand up for yourself, but that's when it should end. You know what I mean? And that's why the Horst Buchholz character to me is like, that is the, even though people are going to focus on Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen and whatever, like that's the sort of message that, with that character, he's almost the central character. You know how like with the good and the bad and the ugly, everyone thinks that Clint Eastwood is the central character, and it's
too cool.
Yeah, it's really what's his face? Eli Wallach's character. Yeah, exactly. Tuco. Like, to me, it's like Horst's character is really the thing that they maybe want you to be focusing on. It's so wild, you know?
It's so, I mean, it's so well done, and in a way subtle, because
those
guys, you know, Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen, they don't change. Like, they've got some wistful moments, but it is really the kid's movie, and it's really his journey from from incredible immaturity to knowing who and what he really is. And it's beautiful when he comes over and he starts scraping the corn and you're like, oh my God, this is just perfect.
Yeah. Oh my God. That amazing scene where he's trying to tell her about like how he snuck into the village, and she's just looking at him and she's just like, you know, and she's not paying attention at all. She's just like, wants to kiss. And he's just like, wait, and I did this. And he's just like oblivious up until she's like right up in his face. It's like so clueless. It's so great. It's funny. I think that one of the things, you know, we kind of have joked about it, but it's just so wild to me that you have this movie that is about a Mexican village, and like, you've got at least three major actors in the movie who are supposed to be the old man is not Mexican, or at least he's not, you know, at least his name doesn't denote, like, my name is Christian Horn, I'm half Colombian. People could be like, he's not Latino. You know what I mean? Horst is not, you know,
Horst,
Latino.
Not Mexican.
Yeah. And Eli Wallach is definitely not. And I think Eli Wallach is probably the impetus for like, Mel Brooks, because Mel Brooks in Blazing Saddles, you know, made himself a Native American Indian because the big joke was like that they would get Jewish actors to be you know, ethnic people like in the movies. So it's just wild to me how like, and the villagers definitely, you know, the minor short parts. But the thing that blows my mind is like, I kept watching this movie and I look at Yul Brynner and I'm like, how? You know what I mean? Because this is a guy who is his ethnic, you know, I mean, maybe not skin color or whatever, but the accent, you know, the attitude or whatever.
The accent.
Yeah. This is a guy who is as ethnic as foreign, quote unquote foreign, as you're going to get in Hollywood. How are we just casting him in the lead role? I mean, the guy's got oozes charisma, but in the lead role of this movie where he's like the badass, and yet none of the other actors are Mexican. Like, you know what I mean? There's not one black person in the whole movie. You know what I mean? And it's just like, but like, it's just like, it was one of those things that I just kept watching. Is like, why? You know, like why? And then I looked up Yul Brynner's like, his story is like fascinating. You know what I mean?
I've got to look him up because I'm always like, he's Russian, right?
Yeah, Russian. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Russian.
And it's just, but he's got that accent and the sort of dark, swarthy looks. And like, I can see why he was a movie star. I mean, but it's also like, I think about the three roles he's most known for are The King and I, where he's playing the Siamese king, which is like, how is that possible?
Yeah, exactly.
And then an Egyptian pharaoh in The Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And then this, where he's, you know, supposedly an all-American cowboy, like named Chris. And you're like, no, and Chris, really?
Well, it's really funny because you commented that. It's funny because you made that comment, like we were texting back and forth, and you're like, it's Chris. I was like, maybe it's short for Christoph, you know? But
maybe.
And you could have pulled that off. I think you could have pulled that off because God knows, like, enough immigrants come to this country and, you know. But at one point in this viewing, like, Harry, the character, who is another character that I absolutely have always loved from the beginning. Get back to him in a second. But he calls him a Cajun. And I'm like, he's like, you old Cajun or something. And I'm like, okay. Like, there could have been a line like that he was like he came as a child, like from, you know, Germany, you know, Europe or whatever. Like it could have been a throwaway. It could have been anything. It could have just fixed the whole thing right there. He's an immigrant because how many immigrants went out west to like find their fortune? You know what I mean?
So,
you know, but he says Cajun. And then there's a part of me like, well, you know, maybe he's from Louisiana. Like, I'm like, okay. Like my brain is like, just trying to be like, okay, maybe he's like first generation Cajun and he's really Russian. Like, you know, there's definitely, but like, going back to that Harry character, I love the dude who's like, there's gold, right? There's like jewels in the hills, right? Like, that's why we're doing this, right? Like, and no matter how many people discourage him or like kind of try and shush him, he just ignores it. He's like, no, you guys are lying.
Hell's on.
He's like, oh no, we're doing this for gold, right? For jewels. And he, quite interestingly, is the first person to like walk off and be like, no, I'm done with this. Like, you guys can go get yourself killed. And then, you know, in kind of a silly scene towards the end, he just like rides in and gets blown away. Like he decides to come back, and they kind of throw that moment away. In my opinion, that was like, okay. Cause he comes riding and he's like, hey Chris, I could get you out. And then just boom, 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 boom.
And that's it's instantly shot, but he does get the second best death scene.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
In the movie. Because, like, that little scene with Chris where Chris tells him, yes, there's gold and there's jewels and it wasn't all for nothing.
Yeah.
And is really lovely.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like a lovely farewell. Yeah. To this character that was sort of comic relief and the you know, there's always the guy who's just all about the money.
Yeah.
And it's really lovely.
Yeah. Brad Dexter is the actor's name. And he plays that really well. I love the look in his eyes where he's just like, this is it, right? Like we were here. Just don't tell me it wasn't for nothing. You know what I mean? And then it's just like, it's just some really great stuff in there. I mean, I cannot, like, and for some reason I thought the movie was like 2.5 hours. It's a little over two, and I think it plays really well. I think, you know, it moves at a good pace, in my opinion.
For it being two, I mean, any movie with horses is long because, you know, horses are big and they take up a lot of space. But it still moves. I've forgotten that there was the chunk where they get kicked out. Like, that was the one sort of section of the movie that I was like, oh, right. There's this whole section where after they chase the bandits off, they're still hanging around for a while. But I want to say this about, like, the Mexican characters, even though many of them are not played by actual Mexicans.
Sure.
We'll forgive Hollywood for that. They are nonetheless beautifully drawn, fully three-dimensional characters who have this great, amazing, even-handed philosophical debate in the middle of this movie. Because one of the big turns in it, there are a couple great turns, like one that they hid their women even from the gunslingers they hired, which is cool. They hid not even their women, basically their girls. And then what the gunslingers find out, the kid sneaks into the bandits' camp to discover that the bandits are actually starving. They need this, and so that they're going to come back, and they have that great conversation about whether or not it's worth it to just give them the food. The villagers, whether or not the villagers should just give them the food or keep fighting, knowing that these guys are going to be desperate and will kill them all, that, like, they're not just going to walk away.
In a way, the bandits are trying to be nice, right? Like,
yeah,
is we in their yeah, own were, weird way.
Yeah, we're not going to kill you. We're not even going to take all of your food. We're just going to take most of it.
No, you're absolutely right. There's some, like, great turns in the story. I totally forgot about the bit where, oh, they're starving. Like, I forgot about it. Like, I sort of remembered as they just come back, you know, but the big, that is, like, you're right. It is an amazing story turn that's unexpected, and it's unexpected to the gunslingers, because even to them, it causes, like, a big debate of, like, listen, man, I thought we were just going to ride in, get rid of these guys, and we'd be done. But now we're talking about, like, these guys are desperate. They're going to kill us. You know what I mean? Like, this isn't about, like, them pillaging every village. I think there's even a line like, we knew that they were, like, taking stuff. We just didn't know that this was, like, the best spot in town. You know what I mean? So it's a great moment where they really all have that realization and are trying to figure out, like, and it's a great bit of character for Yul Brynner to kind of, like, hold them all together. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's so, like, he becomes so invested in standing up to those guys. It's beautiful. God, I love it.
It's just such a good movie. It. And the one thing that I really love, too, is that, you know, and it's a little bit pat, you know, it is a very Hollywood movie sort of thing. But the way that they all sort of find their redemption, especially the ones that needed it, like, towards the end, you know what I mean? James Coburn. Like, I love that James Coburn's, like, the first one to be like, nobody takes my gun from me. And tells me to ride out of town. And the rest of them are like, yeah, you're right about that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And,
yep.
But, you know, before their deaths, they all, like, Robert Vaughn is the one that actually rescues the villagers from, like, the people holding them hostage. You know, he finally, you know, gets his gin up and, you know, conducts a single man raid and shoots a bunch of the bandits and, you know, rescues the villagers. And then I really love the way that he took his shot and then just goes up against the wall and, like, doesn't even fall down, just, like, slides. I was like, man. Yeah. And Robert Vaughn was like, I mean, I know he's the man from Uncle and, Superman 3 and all this stuff. And obviously he's done more than that, you know, but he's an intense dude. Like, really.
Oh, yeah.
Really intense. You know, you just felt he was just, like, going to explode. But, yeah, I think but it really just comes, like, that one moment where it's like, can we walk away or, like,
Right.
Or is this, and there's that sort of message where it's like, okay, these guys are just going to like live by the gun. And it's like, you live by the gun, you die by the gun. Like, you know, you couldn't just walk away and not be a gunslinger. Like it was sort of, it had become in their DNA. And that's sort of like the biggest tragedy of the whole thing. Right. Like, is that you embrace violence and then there's just no way to turn that back around.
There's no way out. But it's also, I don't know, I feel it's also the beauty of like an honorable life, that like honor demands that you go back and you finish this job.
The job's
not done. You know the bandits are going to wind up killing anyone who stands up to them. And you can't just walk away from that, even if, you know, the people in town did send you out. The idea of that's not it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But exactly that. The Red saying, no one throws my gun at me and tells me to get out of town.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, yeah.
But see, for me, like that point is like, it's more about, you know, before the fall, before pride, go, you know, whatever that saying is about pride.
Right.
That to me is like, this is more about pride than it is about the villagers. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's sort of like the bit of a message, and I totally get what you're saying, because I do believe like it is, you know, there, obviously everyone has that point where it's like, no, you know, I've taken all I can stand and I can't stand no more. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just such a great, I love that moment where they're all like in the woods and they're all kind of like looking at each other and they're like, yeah, we're going to have to do this. You know what I mean?
And we're outnumbered, we're outmanned, we're outgunned, but we're still, but honor demands that we do it. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's reflected in, I always want to call him Tuco, even though he's not Tuco.
Yeah,
I can never
remember
Eli Wallach's character in it. But his great last line of like, why did you come back?
Yeah, yeah.
He's so confused. And like, Yul Brynner, you're right. Yul Brynner doesn't have an answer for him.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it just hangs in the air. Like, why would you come back to face near certain death for people who didn't want you here in the first place?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, that Eli Wallach's death scene is like absolutely fantastic, where he's just like, and it's really funny because it's not like a huge moment. Like it passes like really quickly, but he has that speech where he's like, why, like, what are you doing? Like, you're an idiot. Why did you do this? You know? And you're right. Like, Yul Brynner's just like, I mean, to the audience, it's obvious. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's totally the debt of honor of it all.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, so I've got to say, I cannot recommend this movie enough. Like,
oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fantastic. It's available like on Amazon. Turner Classic Movies has it streaming. You know, on their website. So I wouldn't recommend watching it that way, like on a laptop or whatever, but you've got a giant screen. But this definitely, I mean, we didn't really talk about the director, John Sturges. But I mean, he does an amazing job. The movie is amazing. From what I've seen of the reviews of the new one, it's sort of like, you know, it's kind of hard to compete with Perfection. Have you ever seen any of the sequels? Right.
No, I've never seen any of the sequels, and I may watch maybe one episode of the TV show that they had in like the early 80s. But yeah, no.
Oh, I remember the TV show. Yeah. They did one in the 90s too, I think.
Yeah. There don't need to be sequels. I don't mind if there's a remake, and I'm interested because, you know, Antoine Fuqua is an interesting director.
Oh, I think he's a good director. Yeah, yeah.
And so I'm interested to see what he does with it, but I fear that given like the nature of storytelling in 2016, it won't be as sensitive and it'll be a lot blunter. It's apparently way more violent, which is okay.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
I think that, well, my point is like, if you have not seen this movie and you saw the remake in theaters over the weekend and you're like, you weren't that impressed because it seems like it goes back and forth. Maybe it is just, this version is sort of like a popcorn, like action, shoot 'em up, violent, you know, thing. you know, seek this one out because it
yes.
is, well, it is quote unquote, if you've got 3.5 hours, go see The Seven Samurai.
Oh yeah.
This, you know, this is a little bit of an easier pill to swallow. What I found, you know, and making a quick comparison to The Seven Samurai, I find The Seven Samurai to be much more kind of like realistic, like gritty,
oh, yeah.
like darker. And this one is sort of like the, you know, Americanized mythological version of it. I mean, it still definitely has everything that we're talking about, but The Seven Samurai, just, I saw that in the theater a couple years ago for the first time. I'd never seen it all the way through. And I just carved out an afternoon. I was like, I'm going to go see this, a theater showing it. I've never seen, and I just found it to be like emotionally like draining, just like amazingly
yeah.
intense, and just like, wow, what an amazing movie. But this version is maybe a bit more of an easier pill to swallow in a way, but mm-hmm. You know, especially people don't want to read subtitles or whatever, but I think you should want to read subtitles, but you know, definitely seek this out. I mean, it's easy to find online, and it is just, I mean, you know, it's, for lack of a better term, a magnificent movie, you know?
It really is. And it does still really hold up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It does really hold up. And, you know, some beautiful photography, great directing.
Oh, God,
and
yes.
I'm so re-impressed with it all over again. And if you have to, watch it in chunks. I kind of had to do that. That's like sacrilege, I know. But I've seen it on the big screen already. Leave me alone. You know, but it's a fantastic movie. And you cannot do much better than this as far as Westerns go. So any last thoughts on The Magnificent Seven, Jay?
The only other line that I wanted to call out as something that I thought was also really beautiful and touching in its way is that when the guys come to hire Huel Brenner and they tell them basically how little money it is, but it's everything they have.
Oh,
he says, yeah. I've been offered jobs for more money, but never for everything.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's great. This is the kind of thing that should be taught in schools. Like it's such a great movie, and it's so important to, like, I don't know, America. Like, it's just a great thing.
I think, you know, it's really interesting that a Russian would be, especially at the time that it was made, be the lead in an all-American movie. But you're absolutely
exactly.
right. I remember him saying that line, and like, your heart breaks. You're just like, oh, mm-hmm. man. And there's just so many great moments. Like, it's so funny because Yul Brynner, obviously a very talented actor. I actually have a memory seeing him in that revival of...
Oh, yeah?
The King and I. Yeah, I think I was little. My mom took me and I fell asleep. But I specifically remember seeing Yul Brynner like on the stage and being I love The King and I. I like musicals and you know, but he's just, the intelligence of his acting in this is just so dead
yeah.
on. You know, it's very much like, you know that movie Heat, right? Where De Niro mm-hmm. and Pacino.
Yep.
And I don't know about you, but I have a real issue with Pacino, particularly after Son of a Woman. I feel like he just went off the rails. And there's a
yes.
scene, there's the only scene with the two of them in it, and Pacino's like very much like, blah, 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 blah. And De Niro has this look on his face like, what is this guy doing? And he's coming from a very calm, centered, you know, quiet. You know, when De Niro's De Niro, he's on, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
there is definitely, obviously everyone in this movie has different techniques. You can tell that they're all coming from different schools, but you look at like Horst Berchtold's acting and you look at Yul Brynner and it's like, wow, these guys totally went like a different way. And Yul Brynner to me in this movie is just he's the anti-stereotype of what the cool character is. You know what I mean?
Yes.
He doesn't need to be loud. He doesn't need to be like in your face. He doesn't need to be, he's just quiet, calm, cool, but can seethe when he wants to, like deep down inside, like he's seething, like you can see the anger. It's just great. I mean, Yul Brynner, you look at this movie and you're like, that's a star. Like, you know why he's a star.
Yep.
Even though it's like, what? Like, honestly,
exactly.
like out of all the movie stars in the world, like he is the one person where I'm just like, I literally want to pick up a biography or an autobiography, whatever, of him and start reading it now because be like, you like, what? Like, how? Like, it's just like, he was like planning planted there. Like, it's one of those people who you feel like is destined for, like, whatever they were going to do. Like, okay,
oh yeah,
this guy got picked and he's just going to go all the way. So in any case, all right. So this has been the Magnificent Seven 1960 part-time fanboy podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I'm here with my friend Jay Holtham. And you can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and all that good stuff. And please leave us a review on iTunes. Nobody leaves reviews on iTunes. Or not enough, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, that's fine. If you hate us, leave us alone. In any case, thank you for listening, and we will hopefully be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Looking forward to it. Bye.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
I'm doing part-time.
Part-time fanboy.